Imagine you are buying a piece of real estate.
Okay, yeah, I'm picturing it.
So the seller takes you out to this gorgeous property. It's right on the edge of this pristine river.
Sounds nice.
It is. And they spend like 20 minutes just raving about the wraparound porch, the sunset views, and how much the property value is going to appreciate.
That's a whole sales pitch.
Exactly. You are totally sold. So you buy the house, but then like 6 months later, April showers arrive.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, the river crests, and boom, your entire first floor is completely underwater. Now, here's the crazy part. The seller told you the absolute truth about the porch. They didn't lie about the sunsets.
Right, but they left out a massive detail.
Exactly. Yeah. What they conveniently, forgot to mention was that the house sits in a notorious high-risk flood zone.
Yeah, that's a huge problem.
And in the financial world, that exact scenario, pitching the beautiful view while totally omitting the flood risk, it happens every single day.
It really does, all the time.
And when it does happen, it triggers this massive career-ending double whammy of federal liability. So today we are looking at how a single forgotten sentence can literally tear down a financial firm.
It is super
It
intense.
is. But hey, real quick before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel. They've got a full Series 82 course with, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Definitely worth checking out.
For sure. All right, so let's get into it. If you are joining this deep dive today, you are likely staring down the barrel of the Series 82 exam.
And you need this material to actually stick in your brain, right? Not
Yeah.
just bounce off.
Right. So our target today is a section of the exam outline called Communicating Investment Information. And I mean, why should you care about this specific chunk of text?
Because it's huge on the test.
Exactly. This is function three on your outline. It holds three scored items and it represents like 26% of your entire exam.
Yeah, 26% is a massive hurdle. I mean, you basically cannot pass the Series 82 without totally internalizing how these communication rules function in practice.
No way, you fail for sure.
Right. And the tricky part is that the regulators, they don't just want you to memorize some sterile list of prohibited actions.
Yeah, they don't want you just reading flashcards.
Exactly. They want to
Yeah.
test your understanding of the actual mechanics. Like, they want to know if you comprehend what happens when a human being, with all their biases and, financial incentives, sits across a table from another human being.
Right, and starts talking about where to park their life savings.
Exactly. It's all about that human interaction.
And because reading pure regulatory code is basically a fantastic cure for insomnia, we are going to avoid the textbook recitation today.
Thank goodness.
Right. So instead, we're going to rely on a couple of recurring characters to help us like visualize the friction in these rules.
I love this approach.
Yeah, it helps so much. So listener, I want you to picture these two individuals. First, we have Riley the rep.
Good old Riley.
Yep. Riley is an associated person at a broker-dealer. He is super energetic. He loves his job, and he is highly, highly motivated by his commission quota.
Very typical in the industry.
Totally. And he's well-meaning, right? He's a bit of a golden retriever in a suit, but he can be incredibly careless with the fine print.
Which, I mean, in a highly regulated industry, that is a profoundly dangerous personality trait to have.
Oh, a total nightmare for compliance.
Yeah, a golden retriever who routinely forgets federal securities laws is basically a walking liability for any firm.
Exactly. So that's Riley. Now, sitting across the table from Riley, we have our client, Ingrid the investor.
Okay, Ingrid.
Ingrid is a retail customer, and she is deeply risk averse.
Like, keeps her money under the mattress, risk averse.
Almost. I mean, she worked decades to build her nest egg. She is the type of person who actually reads the prospectuses cover to cover.
Wow, rare breed.
Yeah. Her primary goal is capital preservation. She absolutely does not want to lose her principal.
Makes sense. She wants to protect what she has.
Right. So every single time Riley opens his mouth to pitch Ingrid a new financial product, a massive invisible clock basically starts ticking.
And a whole web of regulations just descends right onto the conversation.
Exactly. And before Riley can even describe, a stock or a bond, he has this major preliminary hurdle to clear.
Right. He has to confess his own hidden motives first.
Right. And this brings us squarely into the territory of regulation best interest.
Yeah, commonly known as Reg BI.
Reg BI. Now, could you give us a bit of historical context here? Because I feel like that's crucial for understanding, why this rule operates the way it does.
Oh, absolutely. So for decades, the financial industry operated under something called the suitability standard.
Okay, suitability.
Yeah. Under those old rules, a broker just had to ensure a product was, quote unquote, suitable for a client.
Which sounds fine on the surface, right?
It sounds fine, but in practice, it meant that if there were two identical mutual funds, right, and one paid the broker a massive commission while the other paid nothing, the broker could legally recommend the really expensive one to the client, just so long as it broadly fit the client's risk profile.
Wait, really? That is wild when you actually think about it.
I know.
It basically allowed the broker to put their own paycheck ahead of the client's returns.
Exactly. As long as the product wasn't an outright disaster for the client, it was totally legal.
Man, that's rough.
Yeah. And consumer advocacy groups, I mean, they fought that for years. And it all finally culminated in the SEC adopting regulation best interest.
So Reg BI fundamentally shifted the landscape then.
Totally. It demands that a broker-dealer and its associated persons act in the best interest of the retail customer at the time a recommendation is made.
Okay, at the time of the recommendation.
Right, without placing the financial or other interests of the firm ahead of the customer's interest.
Right, you can't put your own paycheck first anymore.
Exactly. Now, Reg BI actually has four component obligations. But for our scope today, we are zooming in entirely on the disclosure obligation.
Okay, let's unpack the mechanics of this specific disclosure.
Sure.
The core rule says that before or at the time of a recommendation, whether Riley is recommending a specific trade, an overall strategy, or even just like what type of account Ingrid should open,
Right, any of those.
he has to give her full and fair disclosure of all material facts relating to conflicts of interest and the scope of their relationship.
And this is the key. The absolute non-negotiable mechanism of this rule is that the disclosure must be in writing.
Must be in writing. Okay, let me test that because I want to put ourselves in Ingrid's shoes for a second.
Let's do it.
Okay, listener, I want you to set the scene in your head. Riley takes Ingrid out for this super lavish client lunch.
Oh, steakhouse.
Oh, yeah. High-end steakhouse, white tablecloths. The waiter is scraping crumbs off the table with that little metal blade.
Very fancy.
Right. And right as Ingrid is about to verbally agree to transfer a massive amount of assets into a new fund, Riley, you know, he gets a twinge of
The
conscience.
golden retriever comes out.
Exactly. He leans over his sparkling water and says, Ingrid, I want to be totally transparent with you. If you buy this specific fund, my firm gets a massive kickback from the sponsor, and I personally get a commission large enough to buy that jet ski I've been talking about.
Wow. Very honest.
He lays it all out. He is brutally, refreshingly honest. So here's the question for you listening. Has Riley satisfied the Reg BI disclosure obligation? Take a beat and think about it.
Did he clear the hurdle?
Right. Okay. Got your answer.
Based on the strict letter of the SEC's rule, he has completely failed. He is in total violation.
But wait, why? He didn't hide anything from her.
It doesn't matter.
He told her the exact truth right before she made the decision. If the whole point of Reg BI is transparency, hasn't he achieved, like, the spirit of the law?
See, the SEC does not care about the spirit of the law if the mechanics aren't followed.
So verbal honesty gets you nowhere.
Nowhere. And the reason it fails is psychological, and it's evidentiary.
What do you mean by evidentiary?
Well, human memory is fallible, right? If Riley just tells her verbally, what happens 3 years from now when the market tanks and Ingrid claims she never knew about the conflict?
Oh, right. It just becomes a game of he said, she said.
Exactly. There's no proof. Furthermore, I mean, in a high-pressure sales environment like a steakhouse lunch, a verbal disclosure can so easily be rushed or mumbled or sandwiched between exciting numbers to minimize its impact.
Yeah, like, oh, by the way, I get a jet ski, but look at these returns.
Yes, a written document forces the client to actually see the conflict in black and white. It provides a permanent auditable trail. So verbal honesty, while it's nice, has zero regulatory value for this specific obligation.
It must be in writing.
Must be in writing.
And the timing is just as rigid as the format, right? Like, he can't wait until the lunch is over.
Definitely not.
He can't slide a piece of paper across the table after she signs the trade ticket and be like, oh, by the way, for compliance reasons, I need you to just sign this and acknowledge my jet ski money.
Too late.
Yeah.
It has to be before or at the time of the recommendation.
Right.
Okay, so we've established the how and the when. Let's dig into the what. Like, what actually has to be on this piece of paper?
So the sources break this down into two distinct branches. The first branch covers the scope and terms of the relationship.
Okay, scope and term.
Yeah, and the second branch covers the specific conflicts of interest.
You know, I always look at that first branch the scope and terms, kind of like defining a relationship in the modern dating world.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Right. Like before Ingrid commits her money, she needs to look at Riley and ask, what are we, like, what are the boundaries here?
Exactly. The what are we conversation. The SEC actually mandates three specific disclosures under this scope and terms umbrella.
Okay, what's the first one?
The first is capacity. Ingrid needs to know exactly which regulatory hat Riley is wearing.
Right.
Is he acting as a broker-dealer or is he acting as an investment advisor?
Let me stop you there, because to a lot of retail investors like Ingrid, those words are basically synonyms.
Oh, 100%.
Right. A broker, an advisor, a financial planner. To Ingrid, it's all just, you know, the guy who handles my money.
Yeah, the money guy.
So why does the SEC care so deeply that she knows the specific difference?
Because the legal liability and the standard of care shift drastically depending on that capacity.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So an investment advisor operates under a strict, ongoing fiduciary duty under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940.
Okay.
They have to constantly monitor the account and put the client's interests first at all times.
A 247 duty.
Right. But a broker-dealer, historically, they just execute trades and earn commissions.
So it's more transactional.
Exactly. Now, while Ridge BI raised the standard for brokers to act in the best interest at the time of the recommendation, a broker generally doesn't have that same ongoing 247 fiduciary monitoring duty that an advisor does once the trade is done.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
So if Riley is dual registered, meaning he holds licenses to act as both.
Which a lot of them do.
Right. He has to explicitly tell Ingrid, hey, in this specific conversation, for this specific trade, I am acting as a broker.
So she knows exactly what level of service and, I guess, legal protection she is actually getting.
Exactly.
Okay, got it. What's the second requirement under the relationship scope?
Material fees and costs.
Okay.
And the rule casts a very wide net here. It applies to transactions, holdings, and accounts.
So it's not just about the one-time commission Riley makes on the trade.
No, not at all. If there are ongoing maintenance fees for the account, annual custody fees, or even hidden internal expenses within the mutual fund she's holding, all of that must be disclosed.
Oh, they want everything out in the open.
Yeah, the SEC wants Ingrid to have a completely clear picture of the total friction on her capital.
That makes me think of, like, buying an exotic sports car.
Okay. How so?
Well, the sticker price is one thing, right?
Okay.
But you also really need to know that the oil changes are going to cost you like $3,000 and it requires imported tires.
Yes. You need the total cost of ownership.
Right. Okay. So we have capacity and we have fees. What is the third piece of this first branch?
The type and scope of services provided. And crucially, this must include any material limitations on the securities or investment strategies that Riley is allowed to recommend.
Material limitations. Can you give me a concrete example of how that actually plays out in the real world?
Sure. So let's say Riley works for a massive, vertically integrated financial institution. We'll just call it Megabank.
Okay, Megabank.
Megabank has its own asset management division, and they create their own proprietary mutual funds.
Right.
Now, Megabank tells Riley, look, you are only allowed to recommend Megabank mutual funds to your retail clients. You cannot recommend funds from our competitors.
Oh, wow. So he's boxed in.
Exactly. But if Ingrid walks into Riley's office, she might assume he is surveying the entire global financial market to find the absolute best possible investment for her.
Right. She thinks he's looking at everything.
Right. When in reality, he is only looking at a tiny restricted menu of his own firm's proprietary products.
Oh, that is a brilliant distinction. It's totally the difference between walking into a massive grocery store versus walking into an Apple store.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Yeah. In the grocery store, you expect to choose between 100 different brands of cereal. But in the Apple store, you only expect Apple products.
Right.
If Ingrid thinks she's in a grocery store, but Riley is basically operating an Apple store, she is operating under a really dangerous misconception.
Exactly. She needs to know that his universe of options is artificially limited by his employer.
Okay, that is highly material to her decision-making process.
Totally. So just to summarize the first branch quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Capacity, fees, and costs, and scope of services, including any limitations.
Right.
But that only covers the baseline relationship. The second branch of the disclosure obligation is where things get really targeted.
Right. This is where Riley has to put his own financial incentives under the microscope. So branch two requires the disclosure of all material facts relating to conflicts of interest associated with the recommendation. How does the SEC, like, legally define a conflict of interest in this specific context?
Under Reg BI, a conflict of interest is defined as an interest that might incline a broker, dealer, or associated person, consciously or unconsciously, to make a recommendation that is not disinterested.
Oh man, the word unconsciously is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence.
It really is, and it was a very deliberate choice by the regulators.
Right, because they know human nature.
Exactly. The SEC acknowledges human psychology. Riley might genuinely, in his heart of hearts, believe that the Megabank proprietary fund is the absolute greatest investment vehicle on the planet for Ingrid.
He might totally believe it.
He might. He might swear on a stack of prospectuses that his recommendation is totally pure. But if Megabank is paying him a 5% front-end load to sell that fund, while a comparable competitor fund pays him zero, the financial incentive clearly exists.
And it messes with his head.
Exactly. The SEC assumes that incentive will warp his judgment, even if he doesn't realize it's happening.
They're basically legislating human nature. They're saying, we don't care how pure you think your motives are, Riley. The money creates a gravitational pull on your ethics.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And notice that the SEC is not banning the conflict.
Oh, right. Because commissions still exist.
Exactly. The entire financial industry is built on various commission and compensation structures. If they banned them, it would halt the capital markets completely.
Right. So the goal isn't prohibition.
No. The goal is sunlight. If Ingrid knows about the 5% payout, she can adjust her own internal skepticism meter.
She can ask harder questions.
Exactly. The disclosure empowers the investor to weigh the recommendation accurately.
Okay, I want to pump the brakes right here because this exact concept creates one of the most lethal exam traps on the Series 82.
Oh yeah, this is a big one.
Listener, I need you to put your test-taking hat on for a second. We just spent all this time talking about how Riley has to provide a written document detailing his conflicts of interest before the recommendation.
Right.
But earlier in your study journey, you had to learn about a completely different document called Form CRS, the Customer Relationship Summary.
Yes, Form CRS. It was implemented around the same time as Reg BI and is a foundational document for retail investors.
Right. And we know for a fact that Form CRS contains a section detailing the firm's conflicts of interest.
It does.
So let me challenge you on this, listener. Let's say Ingrid opened her account a month ago. During the account opening process, Riley handed her a pristine, perfectly SEC-compliant Form CRS.
Okay.
It lists Megabank's compensation structures. It lists their proprietary product limitations. It covers the broad strokes of all the conflicts.
Right.
Now we're at the steakhouse lunch a month later, and Riley wants to recommend a specific bond fund. Does he really need to generate a second, separate Reg BI written disclosure?
Think about it.
I mean, isn't that bureaucratic redundancy? Doesn't the delivery of Form CRS satisfy the Reg BI disclosure obligation?
Take a second. What do you think?
Okay, what's the verdict?
If you answer yes to that on the exam, you will instantly lose the points.
Instantly.
The answer is a definitive, absolute no. Delivering Form CRS does not satisfy the Reg BI disclosure obligation.
But why, though? I mean, if they both talk about conflicts, why make the rep and the client wade through all that paperwork twice? What is the regulatory logic there?
It really comes down to timing and specificity.
Timing and specificity, okay.
Think about the psychology of an investor at account opening. When Ingrid gets Form CRS, she is filling out dozens of pages of new account forms, verifying her address, setting up bank links, all of that.
She's just signing on the dotted line over and over.
Exactly. She is overwhelmed with onboarding paperwork. The conflicts listed in Form CRS are very broad firm-level summaries. It's just a high-level overview. By contrast, the Reg BI disclosure is point of sale. It is recommendation specific. When Riley pitches the bond fund at lunch, that is the exact moment Ingrid is actually making a financial decision that puts her capital at risk.
So they need the warning right then and there.
Yes. The SEC demands that the conflict disclosure be immediate and tailored to that specific transaction.
I love the theme park brochure analogy for this.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, so like Form CRS is basically the glossy brochure they hand you when you walk through the main gates of the theme park.
The map.
Exactly. It tells you generally, hey, we have roller coasters. Some of them are super fast. And by the way, the food is really expensive. It's good information, but it's totally abstract.
Right.
The Reg BI disclosure is the giant red warning sign bolted to the turnstile of the specific roller coaster you are about to strap yourself into.
Yeah.
It says, this specific ride goes 80 miles an hour. It loops upside down 3 times. And if you have a heart condition, do not get on. You cannot use the general brochure at the front gate as a legal shield to avoid putting the specific warning sign on the ride itself.
That is exactly how the SEC views it.
Yeah.
The sources are explicitly clear on this. Delivering Form CRS does not relieve a firm of any other disclosure obligations arising under federal securities laws.
So they're completely separate.
They're two separate duties, triggered at two separate times, serving two totally separate psychological purposes for the investor.
Right.
So if an exam question asks if Form CRS covers the Reg BI requirement, the answer is always no.
Okay, so Riley avoids the trap. He doesn't rely on Form CRS. He hands Ingrid a specific written Reg BI disclosure right there at the lunch table before he starts his actual pitch.
Perfect.
He outlines his capacity as a broker, the transaction fees, his firm's limitations, and of course, the massive commission he's going to make.
The jet ski money.
The jet ski money. So Ingrid reads it, she digests it, she understands the biases at play, and she looks at him and says, okay, Riley, I know why you want to sell this to me. I see the jet ski money. Now, tell me about the actual product.
And here's where we shift gears.
Right. Riley has cleared the disclosure hurdle. Now, the regulatory spotlight moves away from why he's making the pitch and shines directly on what he actually says about the investment.
And this transition moves us right into the realm of the fair and balanced standard for product characteristics and risks.
Okay, let's define the baseline here. When Riley opens his mouth to describe a mutual fund, a stock, or like a private placement, what is the overarching rule governing his words?
The core mandate is that any description of an investment product must rest on principles of fair dealing and good faith.
Fair dealing and good faith.
Yes. The presentation must be fair and balanced, and crucially, it must provide the customer with a sound basis for evaluating the facts regarding that specific product.
A sound basis for evaluation? I mean, that sounds incredibly subjective. How does a regulator actually enforce something like fair and balanced?
That's the tricky part, right? They usually enforce it by looking at what their rep didn't say. Yeah, the biggest trap for brokers isn't usually an outright bald-faced lie.
Right. They aren't usually just making stuff up.
Exactly. The trap is the omission of material facts. The rule specifically states that you cannot omit a material fact if leaving that fact out would make your overall description misleading.
Which brings us right back to the real estate analogy we started the show with.
Exactly.
If I'm selling you that house and I talk for 20 minutes straight about the beautiful wraparound porch and the incredible sunset views, every single word I say might be factually true.
Right. The porch is nice.
The porch is great. But if I intentionally omit the fact that the house is in a severe flood zone and takes on 3 feet of water every April, my pitch is deeply misleading. I haven't given you a sound basis to evaluate the property.
No, you've completely distorted the reality.
So in the securities world, how does this actually manifest?
It manifests through what we call the paired risk requirement.
The paired risk requirement.
Yeah. The SEC and FINRA have made it abundantly clear that in retail communications and recommendations, a stated benefit cannot exist in a vacuum. It cannot stand alone.
It needs a chaperone.
I love that. Yes.
Yeah.
It needs a chaperone. Every time you promote a specific benefit, whether that is, you know, a high target yield, a unique tax advantage, or rapid growth potential, you must immediately pair it with the corresponding risk that could prevent that benefit from being realized,
mm-hmm.
or the risk that the client assumes to chase that benefit.
So you can't talk about the porch without talking about the flood water.
Exactly.
Okay, let's run a scenario because I want to make sure the listener is tracking the logic here.
Sounds good.
Let's say Riley looks at Ingrid and says, Ingrid, this specific municipal bond fund has a 10% target yield. Now, let's assume Riley actually did his research for once.
Wow, a rare moment.
Right. He pulled the prospectus. That 10% figure is a 100% mathematically verified, unassailable, true fact.
Okay, so it's a true statement.
Yes. If Riley stops talking right there, is his statement compliant with the fair and balanced standard?
Right.
Listener, take a second. What do you think?
Is the mathematical truth enough?
Okay, so what's the answer?
Put yourself in the regulator's shoes. The answer is absolutely not. It is a violation.
But it's true. How can telling the mathematical truth be a regulatory violation?
Because the truth, when isolated like that, becomes a distortion.
Right?
Think about it. To a risk-averse retail investor like Ingrid, a 10% yield sounds like magic.
It sounds amazing.
It acts as an anchor. Her brain immediately starts calculating how much money she'll make. But what Riley didn't mention is why the yield is 10%.
There's always a catch.
Always. In the fixed income world, yield and risk are directly correlated. If a bond fund is yielding 10% in, say, a 4% interest rate environment, it means the fund is buying highly speculative junk status debt.
So companies that are basically on the verge of bankruptcy.
Exactly. By stating the 10% yield without stating the massive credit risk, Riley has totally deprived Ingrid of a sound basis for evaluation. A true statement violated the standard entirely because of what it left out.
The missing pair is the violation.
Yes.
So to make that compliant, Riley has to say, this fund has a 10% target yield, but to achieve that, it invests in lower rated high yield debt, which carries a significant risk of loss of your principal.
Yes, that is fair and balanced. The benefit and the risk are presented together, allowing the investor to actually weigh them against each other.
The sources outline a few specific pairings that are highly testable,
they
right?
They do, yeah.
So if Riley pitches a high yield, he has to pair it with the risk of loss of principal. What if he's pitching, say, a private placement? Let's say he tells Ingrid, this private real estate syndicate offers incredible tax deferral advantages. What is the mandatory paired risk there?
For privately placed securities, which remember do not trade on a public exchange, the most critical paired risk is usually illiquidity.
Illiquidity.
Yeah. Riley must disclose the absence of a public trading market. He has to tell her, look, you get the tax advantage, but your money is locked up. You cannot easily sell this if you suddenly need cash.
And listener, this is exactly how they will test you on the Series 82. The exam writers know human psychology just as well as the regulators do.
Oh, they absolutely do.
They will give you a question stem that features a broker making a statement with one single isolated number. They will say, a rep states that a fund provides a 6% tax-free return, and then they will ask if the communication is compliant.
And your brain will instinctively want to say yes.
Right, because 6% sounds like a normal factual number, but you have to train your brain to instantly scan the rest of the sentence for the paired risk. If you see a benefit naked, standing all by itself without a risk chaperone, you must flag it as a violation.
That is a perfect heuristic for the exam. Never credit a solo benefit as compliant.
Never.
And it's important to note, while we talk a lot about risk, the fair and balanced standard also applies heavily to costs.
Oh, really?
Yeah. For example, if Riley pitches a variable annuity by highlighting its guaranteed minimum income benefit, but he fails to mention the exorbitant surrender charges if Ingrid needs to pull her money out early.
Oh, man. Those surrender charges can be brutal.
They really can. So if he omits that, he has omitted a material fact that makes the pitch misleading.
Okay, so we understand the mechanics of the content standard. You have to paint the whole picture. But let's look at the consequences. Let's say Riley messes up. He pitches the 10% yield, gets distracted by the waiter bringing over those fancy steaks, and totally forgets to mention the risk of losing her principal.
Classic Riley.
Right, so he omitted a material fact. The pitch was misleading. What actually happens to Riley? Is this just like an internal compliance issue where he gets a stern talking to and has to take a training module?
Oh, no. No. The consequences scale rapidly into federal territory.
Federal territory.
Yes. And this brings us to a concept I like to call the double whammy of omissions.
The double whammy. I love that.
When Riley leaves out that material fact, he doesn't just violate the FINRA or SEC fair and balanced content standard. That exact same omission independently triggers anti-fraud liability under federal securities laws.
Whoa, wait a minute. Anti-fraud.
Yep.
Fraud is a really heavy word. Fraud implies malice. It implies a scheme. Let me push back on this a bit because this feels overly punitive.
Okay, let's hear it.
I told you earlier, Riley is a golden retriever. He's not some criminal mastermind.
Right.
What if he genuinely, honestly just forgot? He got excited about the yield, he wanted Ingrid to be happy, and the risk disclosure simply slipped his mind. There was zero evil intent. He wasn't trying to steal her money. Are you telling me that a simple memory lapse makes him guilty of fraud?
This is one of the most vital legal distinctions in securities regulation, and you will absolutely be tested on it. So let's separate this into two distinct buckets.
Okay, two buckets.
Bucket one is the content standard violation, the fair and balanced rule. Does Riley need intent, what lawyers call scienter, to violate the content standard?
I'm guessing no, because a rule about content just measures what was actually said out loud.
Correct. Zero intent is required. If the material fact was omitted and the pitch became misleading, the rule's broken. Stupidity, forgetfulness, or, you know, getting distracted by a waiter, none of those are viable legal defenses for a content standard violation.
Okay, that makes sense. He broke the communication rule by being sloppy. But what about bucket two, the anti-fraud liability? Surely you need intent to be charged with fraud.
Here is where the regulatory net is cast incredibly wide. While some specific fraud charges do require intent, the broader anti-fraud provisions of the Securities Act and the Exchange Act are designed to capture the effect of the communication on the investor, regardless of the broker's internal mindset.
The effect of the communication. Let's dig into that architecture, because the sources specifically reference both the Securities Act and the Exchange Act. Let's start with the Securities Act of 1933. How does its anti-fraud provision operate?
So the Securities Act of 1933 primarily regulates the primary market, the initial offer and sale of securities. Mm-hmm. Its anti-fraud provision, specifically Section 17A, makes it unlawful for any person in the offer or sale of any security to do three things.
Okay, what's number one?
Number one, employ any device, scheme, or artifice to defraud. That's your classic intentional scam.
Right, the Ponzi scheme stuff, bad guys doing bad things on purpose.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Number two, to obtain money or property by means of any untrue statement of a material fact or any omission to state a material fact necessary in order to make the statements made in light of the circumstances under which they were made, not misleading.
Boom. There it is. That is the exact trap Riley fell into.
Yes, it is.
He omitted the risk of principal loss, which was absolutely necessary to keep his statement about the 10% yield from being misleading. By simply opening his mouth and telling half the story, he walked right into the crosshairs of federal anti-fraud law.
And the third prong of the Securities Act provision makes it unlawful to engage in any transaction, practice, or course of business which operates or would operate as a fraud or deceit upon the purchaser.
Notice the phrasing there. Operates as a fraud.
Exactly.
It doesn't say you intended a fraud. It says the outcome of your action functioned as a deceit upon the buyer.
Right. Now, the Exchange Act of 1934 has a similar mechanism, but that applies to the secondary market.
Right, the trading market.
Correct. The general anti-fraud rule of the Exchange Act applies to conduct in connection with the purchase or sale of any security, whether it's a new issue or trading on an exchange. And it broadly bars the same core conduct: schemes to defraud, untrue statements, misleading omissions, and acts that operate as a fraud.
Okay, if I step back and look at this from a high level, the regulatory logic is actually fascinating.
How do you mean?
Well, by structuring the law this way, the SEC is making a very deliberate philosophical choice about who bears the burden of competence.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Right. Because if they required proof of intent for every misleading pitch, a broker could just play dumb every single time they lost a client's money.
Oh, I didn't mean to mislead her. I'm just bad at my job.
Exactly. The SEC is saying, we don't care if you're malicious or just incompetent. The damage to the retail investor is exactly the same.
Yes.
If Ingrid loses her retirement fund because Riley actively lied, or if she loses it just because Riley forgot to mention the risk, she is still bankrupt. The result is the same.
Exactly. The Securities Act explicitly focuses on the purchaser. Its specific fraud on the purchaser clause is designed to build a literal fortress around the buyer. It shifts the entire burden of accuracy, completeness, and competence onto the professional.
That is a phenomenal summary of the regulatory intent. The system is asymmetrical by design.
It has to be.
Right, because the professional has the licenses, the training, and all the resources of the firm. Therefore, the professional bears the absolute liability for the words they speak. Ingrid should not have to suffer financial devastation because her broker has a bad memory.
Totally.
Let me throw a modern curveball at this just to see how the rule flexes in real life.
All right, Amy.
We're talking about Riley making a verbal mistake at lunch. But what if this happens digitally?
Like in an email.
Yeah. Let's say Riley's firm uses a massive CRM system to send out automated marketing emails. Riley clicks a button to send a pitch about a tax-free bond to 1,000 clients.
Okay.
But there's a glitch in the software, and the paragraph containing the paired risk disclosure gets accidentally deleted in the formatting process.
Oh, yikes.
The email goes out with just the isolated benefit. No human being intended for that to happen. It was a literal machine error. Does the firm still get hit with the double whammy?
Under the strict interpretation of these rules, yes, absolutely. The firm is responsible for the communications it disseminates. The fact that an algorithm or a software glitch caused the omission does not cure the fact that the resulting communication was materially misleading.
So they're still on the hook.
They are. The firm would face a content standard violation and, depending on the fallout, potential anti-fraud exposure because the communication operated as a deceit upon the purchasers who read it.
That is wild.
The SEC has repeatedly fined firms for automated compliance failures. The lack of human intent is simply not a shield.
That is terrifying for compliance officers, but I mean, it makes total sense given the priority to protect the purchaser. So, listener, let's lock this in. On the exam, one single material omission equals two distinct exposures.
Two exposures.
First, it violates the fair and balanced content standard, which requires zero intent. Second, it triggers anti-fraud liability because the omission makes the pitch operate as a deceit on the buyer. Two massive problems stemming from one missing sentence.
And remember to link the Securities Act specifically to the protection of the purchaser. If a question asks who that specific anti-fraud provision is designed to shield, the answer is always the defrauded buyer.
Okay, let's check back in on our lunch date with Riley and Ingrid.
Back to the steakhouse. Yeah.
The dynamic at the table has kind of shifted, right? Riley has handed over his Reg BI disclosure showing his massive commission.
Right.
He pitched a product. And let's assume he actually remembered the paired risk this time. So he told her about the potential to lose her principal.
Good job, Riley.
But Ingrid is sitting there, sipping her water, processing all of this, and she is inherently skeptical.
As she should be.
She's looking at Riley, looking at this lavish steakhouse, and she starts wondering about the health of Megabank itself.
Oh, this is interesting pivot.
She thinks this guy is pushing high-risk products and taking huge commissions. Is his firm actually financially stable, or are they leveraged to the hilt and quietly going broke behind the scenes? She wants to look under the hood.
She wants to see the numbers.
Right. Can she demand to see Megabank's accounting?
She absolutely can, under a very specific set of conditions. And this introduces the rules surrounding furnishing the firm's financial condition.
Okay, let's start with the baseline rule. What exactly is a broker-dealer required to provide if a client questions their financial stability?
The overarching mandate is that a broker-dealer must make information about its financial condition available for inspection by certain customers upon request.
And what information specifically?
Specifically, they are required to provide the firm's most recent balance sheet.
The balance sheet. Assets, liabilities, equity. A snapshot of the firm's financial health.
Right.
Okay, but you said certain customers. This is where the SEC loves to draw lines in the sand. I imagine I can't just like walk off the street into a Goldman Sachs lobby, having never done business with them, and demand to see their internal balance sheet, right?
Correct. The right to demand this internal financial document is not a universal public right. It is restricted to a very specific classification of person, which the rule defines as a bona fide regular customer.
A bona fide regular customer. That sounds like a very specific legal term of art. What is the actual definition? Like, how do you earn that status?
The rule defines a bona fide regular customer as any person who, in the regular course of the firm's business, has cash or securities in the firm's possession.
Cash or securities in the firm's possession. So it's all about custody.
Exactly.
It's about having skin in the game. If the firm isn't holding your assets, their internal financial health is really none of your business.
Right.
But if they're holding your money, you have a vested interest in knowing they aren't about to go bankrupt and lock up your funds in, you know, a SIPC proceeding.
Exactly. The risk of the firm's insolvency only directly impacts you if they have custody of your capital.
Okay, let's pressure test this definition with a few scenarios, listener, because I guarantee the exam will give you hypothetical clients and ask if they qualify.
Oh, for sure.
Scenario one, Ingrid. She opened her account 3 years ago. She holds shares of an S&P 500 index fund, and she has $5,000 sitting in a cash sweep account. Is she a bona fide regular customer? Take a second.
Think about the definition.
Yes, unequivocally. The firm has possession of both her securities, the index fund shares, and her cash. She has the full right to request the balance sheet.
Exactly. She qualifies.
Scenario two. Let's invent a new character. Dave, the day trader.
Okay, Dave.
Dave trades entirely on margin. He doesn't actually have any net positive cash at the firm. In fact, he actively owes the money. But the firm is holding the securities he bought on margin as collateral. Can Dave ask for the balance sheet? Listener, what do you think?
Cash or securities?
Right. Yes. The definition specifies cash or securities. Even if his cash balance is technically negative, the firm is in possession of securities in his account. He is a bona fide regular customer.
Spot on.
Okay, scenario three, the ghost client. Let's say a guy named Steve walked into Riley's office yesterday.
Okay, Steve.
He filled out all the new account paperwork, he signed all the agreements, and the account is officially open in the system. But Steve hasn't actually transferred any money yet.
Nothing funded.
Nothing. He hasn't deposited a check, hasn't wired any funds, hasn't AC transferred any stocks. The account balance is 0.00. Is Steve a bona fide regular customer?
Based strictly on the regulatory definition provided in the sources, a person who has cash or securities in the firm's possession, Steve does not yet meet the threshold.
So he's out.
Right. He is a customer in name. But until the firm actually takes physical or digital possession of his assets, he does not have the statutory right to compel them to produce the balance sheet under this specific rule.
That is a brilliant distinction for the exam. The trigger is possession of assets, not just a signed piece of paper.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've established Ingrid has the right to ask. Back at the lunch table, she looks at Riley and says, "Riley, I want to see Megabank's most recent balance sheet."
Boo.
Now, the rule says the firm must make it available for inspection. Does that mean Ingrid gets to, like, march out of the restaurant, walk into Megabank's headquarters, push past the receptionist, sit down at the chief financial officer's desk, and physically audit the accounting ledgers?
No, the SEC does not grant retail investors the right to conduct a hostile takeover of the back office.
Bummer for Ingrid.
Yeah. While the rule uses the phrase available for inspection, it explicitly provides an alternative compliance method for the broker-dealer. The firm may choose to deliver the balance sheet to the requesting customer instead.
Oh, so the firm holds the power to dictate the venue.
They do.
They can substitute delivery for physical inspection. Riley can just say, absolutely not, you cannot come into the back office, but I will send the document to you.
Correct. The choice belongs entirely to the firm. If they deliver the balance sheet, they have fully satisfied the rule, and the customer has no further right to demand an on-site physical inspection.
Okay, this brings us to the actual mechanics of delivery. And listener, if you are multitasking, come back to me right now, because this is one of the most highly tested gotcha concepts regarding client communication.
Pay attention to this part.
When Riley says, I will deliver the balance sheet to you, he has two primary avenues, paper or electronic.
Right.
And the rules governing those two avenues are wildly different. Let's start with paper. If Riley reaches into his briefcase at the restaurant, pulls out a physical printed copy of the balance sheet, and just hands it across the table to Ingrid, does he need her special consent to do that?
No. Paper delivery is the traditional default. No prior consent is required to hand a customer a physical piece of paper, or even to drop a physical copy in the mail to their address on file.
Paper is easy, but Riley is a modern guy. He doesn't want to carry around stacks of balance sheets.
Right, he's got a smartphone.
Exactly. He says, Ingrid, I have our balance sheet right here on my phone. I'll just email you a PDF of it right now, or, you know, I'll shoot you a link to our secure client portal. Can Riley just default to electronic delivery to save a tree?
Absolutely not. This is where firms get fined constantly. Electronic delivery requires the customer's prior consent to receive that specific information electronically.
Prior consent.
Yes. A firm cannot unilaterally decide to shift a regulatory disclosure from paper to digital without the client actively agreeing to that format beforehand.
Why is the SEC so rigid about this? I mean, we live in a digital world. I get my water bill by email. Why is a balance sheet treated like nuclear launch codes where you need affirmative consent?
It stems from the ESANE Act and longstanding SEC guidance on electronic delivery. The regulators operate on the assumption that every single investor knows how to open an envelope. They do not assume every investor has reliable internet access, knows how to open a PDF, or regularly checks their email.
Oh, I see.
Right, so if Megabank emails the balance sheet, but it goes to Ingrid's spam folder, or maybe she doesn't know how to navigate the encrypted portal, she hasn't actually received the disclosure.
It's useless to her.
Exactly.
That.
By forcing the firm to get prior consent, the SEC ensures that Ingrid is actively verified. Yes, I have the technological capability and the desire to receive this information digitally.
That makes total sense when you frame it around investor capability. So let's turn this into an exam cheat code for the listener.
Let's hear it.
If you are taking the Series 82 and you see a question about furnishing the financial condition, if the question asks about physical inspection, do you need consent? No. If it asks about mailing a paper copy, do you need consent? No. But the millisecond your eyes see the words electronic, email, PDF, or portal in the question stem, alarm bells must go off in your brain. You must immediately scan the answer choices for the word consent. If there is no prior consent mentioned, electronic delivery is a violation.
That is exactly how to navigate those questions. Perfect. And there is one final detail regarding the balance sheet itself.
What's that?
Riley can't just hand over a rosy balance sheet from 3 years ago when the market was booming.
Mm.
The rule specifies two constraints on the document itself. First, it must be the firm's most recent balance sheet.
Mm.
Second, it must be prepared under the firm's usual practice, as required by federal or state securities laws or any rule under those laws.
So it has to be the official, compliant, totally up-to-date accounting, not some, you know, marketing brochure disguised as a balance sheet.
Precisely. No funny business.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of regulatory ground today.
We really have.
We've watched Riley navigate the treacherous waters of Ridge BI conflict disclosures. We've seen him stumble through the fair and balanced standard with his isolated yield pitches. We've explored how a simple omitted sentence triggers the double whammy of content and anti-fraud violations under the Securities and Exchange Acts.
And we covered balance sheets.
And finally, yes, we've walked through the mechanics of a bona fide customer demanding to see the firm's financial receipts. So, listener, to make sure this is absolutely locked into your short-term memory before you go take a practice exam, we are going to do a rapid-fire recap of the most critical, highly testable concepts from this deep dive.
Let's do it.
I will set up the concept. You knock down the rule. Let's go. Number one, the Reg BI disclosure obligation regarding conflicts of interest. What are the non-negotiable mechanics?
It must be provided in writing, and it must be delivered before or at the time of the recommendation. Verbal disclosures do not count.
And what is the ultimate exam trap regarding this disclosure?
Form CRS. Delivering Form CRS at account opening does not satisfy the point of sale Reg BI disclosure obligation. They are two separate mandatory duties. Form CRS is the general brochure. Reg BI is the specific ride warning.
Awesome. Number two, the fair and balanced standard. How do we treat stated benefits?
The paired risk requirement. A stated benefit, like a high yield or tax advantage, cannot stand alone. It must be paired with the corresponding risk, such as loss of principal or illiquidity. A mathematically true statement can still be a violation if it omits a material fact that makes it misleading.
Number three, the double whammy of omissions. What happens when a rep leaves out a material fact?
One omission creates two exposures. First, it violates the fair and balanced content standard, which requires absolutely zero intent to violate. Negligence is enough. Second, that same omission independently triggers anti-fraud liability under the Securities Act and the Exchange Act because it operates as a deceit on the buyer.
And who is the Securities Act's anti-fraud provision specifically designed to protect?
The purchaser, the defrauded buyer.
Finally, number four, furnishing the firm's financial condition. Who gets to ask for the balance sheet?
A bona fide regular customer, which is strictly defined as someone who has cash or securities in the firm's possession.
Can the firm refuse an on-site physical inspection?
Yes. The firm can choose to substitute delivery of the balance sheet in place of an on-site inspection.
And what is the golden rule of delivery methods?
Paper delivery requires no consent. Electronic delivery requires the customer's prior affirmative consent.
Fantastic. Listener, if you can recall those pillars and understand the why behind them, you will absolutely dominate Function 3 on this exam.
You'll crush it.
As we wrap up our deep dives, we always like to leave you with something to ponder, you know, like a thread to pull on that stretches beyond the textbook and looks at the horizon of the industry.
Yeah, and we spent a lot of time today talking about human error.
We did.
Riley, forgetting to mention a risk. Or a compliance officer dropping a paragraph. We established that you do not need intent to violate the content standard, and that unintentional omissions can trigger massive anti-fraud liability.
Right.
Because the law prioritizes protecting the purchaser.
Right.
But look at where the financial industry is sprinting right now. We are moving rapidly toward AI-generated product summaries, algorithmic pitch decks, and large language models drafting client communications on the fly.
That is a whole other thing to wrap your head around.
It is. Think about what happens when a machine learning model, optimizing purely for client engagement, decides that RIF disclosures lower conversion rates and just quietly drops a material fact from a mass email.
Wow.
If an AI algorithm omits a paired risk without any human intent whatsoever, and it operates as a fraud on 1,000 purchasers simultaneously, who absorbs the anti-fraud liability?
That is the million-dollar question.
Is it the rep who blindly clicked approve on the AI draft? Is it the broker-dealer firm who licensed the software? Or is the regulatory framework going to have to adapt to hold the software developers accountable?
It's crazy to think about.
The rules we study today were written in the 1930s for human beings sitting in city houses. In the next 5 years, they're going to collide head-on with artificial intelligence, and the fallout is going to redefine compliance.
That is a staggering thought. The law always lags behind the technology, but the liability is always present. Keep that in mind as you head into the industry. Make sure you check out certfuel.com to keep drilling these concepts with their adaptive quizzes. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Go crush your Series 82 exam, and we will catch you next time.